The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
Well, US President Donald Trump has been highly critical of many people lately, but he has directed a lot of anger at China, in particular because of the coronavirus.
This is really the worst attack we've ever had. This is worse than Pearl Harbor. This is worse than the World Trade Center. There's never been an attack like this. And it should have never happened. Could have been stopped at the source. Could have been stopped in China.
Well, one of China's biggest companies, Huawei, has been at the centre of weakening of East-West relations in recent months. This week, it was reported the US won't allow their fighter jets to countries that have Huawei's 5G network for security reasons. Joe Kelly, a Donegal man, is a Huawei senior executive. He's vice president of their corporate communications. And we caught up with him yesterday, and I first suggested to him that we're hearing a lot about things returning to normal in China. So what is day-to-day life like there?
Now, if I describe life, we go about life as normal, except we wear masks. So wearing a mask is mandatory. If you go to a shopping mall, they will check your temperature before you go inside. But by and large, life is almost back to normal.
What does that look like in the streets? What I mean is, are many people actually going into the shops? What does it look like in cafes or restaurants?
Yeah, people go to shops, go to cafes, go to restaurants. They go about their business. They push their kids in prams on the streets. They go for beers if they drink beer. Maybe some restaurants will check your temperature before you get inside. And it's just one of these cursory handheld temperature thermometer things. They'll shoot your wrist or maybe shoot your forehead, take your temperature, and beyond that, life is normal. I mean, I do think that there's probably fewer people in shopping malls than maybe there was before.
The Irish bars are open, Joe. You're able to go in for a pint, are you?
I've been known to go to the Irish bar for a pint from time to time, and I go to non-Irish bars too. There are three Irish bars in the city of Shenzhen.
In industry, we were talking to a correspondent from the Wall Street Journal there a few weeks ago, and she was talking about the kind of social distancing measures that are applying, whether it's in relation to sanitation, whether it's in relation, you know, sanitizing hands, whether it's in relation to how far people work while apart or sit apart from each other in the canteen, in the workplace, etc. What's all that like? And is it affecting people's ability to work, the productivity of the economy?
There might be 20% of people who still haven't gone back to work in their office. Maybe they're still working from home, but it's pretty advanced in terms of getting back to normal. In the early days of the virus, many people who don't have cars were renting cars to drive themselves because they didn't want to sit in the bus with other people. But I've noticed now that most of those people are now back to travelling to work by bus, and the buses are full of people. So it's been quite a rapid but progressive change over the last three or four weeks.
One of the fallouts from the coronavirus pandemic has been a deterioration, I suppose, in relations between the West and China. There's a lot of tension around it. There were tensions around trade with Donald Trump prior to this, but it seems to be getting worse.
I think that's a fair representation. You know, if you go back to life before the virus, and I've made this observation for a very long time, there is a huge cultural chasm between the West and China. The West don't really understand China, and to be honest, China doesn't really understand the West either. Speaking for myself and not for the company I work for, I think that there are certainly people who want to deflect from their own record of managing the virus in certain countries, and it's easier to blame somebody else. But the tensions were there before. Yes, they have got a little harder. But I would want to say one thing. I do think there's a very distinct difference between the attitude of the US government and European governments. And while I would accept and agree that there is a deterioration across the board, I think there is a more open dialogue between China and European countries than there are between China and the US at the moment.
But even in that openness, it was interesting that there was a letter written from the EU, and details of it were published in a Chinese newspaper, I think a state-controlled newspaper, where it just made a very anodyne, non-committal, non-blaming reference to the fact that the virus had begun in China and that was taken out.
Listen, of course, it's a sensitive time. You know, there have been lots of finger pointing, maybe unhelpful finger pointing. The US is taking a very aggressive line, but there is at least more support for China through this, both support for China from overseas and support from China back to other countries, than there are people who want to keep pointing fingers and being aggressive.
What about your own background, Joe, and a long road, a long journey, I suspect, to China? You're originally from Letterkenny.
Born in Letterkenny, lived there till I was in my early 20s. I'm from a family of six kids. My dad was a butcher. My mother worked in an office. I'm a twin, identical twin. And I left school at 15. I went to work for Anpost. Worked there for several years as a junior postman delivering telegrams back in the day when we had telegrams. And then I became a postman for a short time, and then I became a postal sorter. And then I decided it was time to do something different. Then I moved into journalism for a while, went to work in corporate comms, first for a couple of PR firms, and then I moved to an American company called Xerox, who make photocopiers, and then from there to a company called Marconi, which was a Western telecoms equipment company. And from there I moved to BT. And at BT, I met this Chinese company called Huawei. And then I worked with them over an eight-year period, doing various things. And 8 years later, the third time of asking, I agreed to come to China and work for the company here. I had kind of reached a conclusion. 20 years in London was getting close to living more than half my life outside of Ireland. At that point, I thought, you know, I've got to do something a little bit different.
Joe, when you look around at life there in Shenzhen and you look at rich and poor, you know, it's still described as a communist country. It's very different to what our old perceptions of communism was about or should be about or could be about. How do you see that sort of contrast between rich and poor there?
Maybe I live a privileged life. I don't see much of the poor. But here's what I do see. I see a population that has a very different relationship with this government than the Irish do or the British do. People look to their government to do things that in the West you can't look to your government to do.
They're also afraid of their government, surely. Afraid to criticise their government. When you look at a single party state, you look at Xi Jinping, leader for life, and you look at the whole question of human rights abuses.
I don't know every Chinese person. I know quite a few. I don't know anybody that's frightened or expressed fear of their government.
Now, the 5G controversy really sort of kicked off in the public's mind when the daughter of the founder of the company was arrested in Canada. On foot of a US investigation talking about violations of trade sanctions against Iran. And China then responded by detaining and imprisoning two Canadians. And very quickly then, this whole question of safety and security and the integrity of the data and the systems behind 5G, if they're provided by Huawei, would the Chinese government ultimately have some sort of access to them if they wanted. That's when that all really kicked off. I mean, you found yourself in the middle of a sort of a PR firefight there.
I did. But in truth, the firefight started in 2012. Huawei was effectively banned from selling its technology in the US to telecoms operators on the basis of national security threat. Incidentally, not one single iota of evidence has ever been presented against the company. We've been found guilty of no crime, but the campaign did intensify quite a lot with the advent of 5G. But I do think it's important to bear in mind that this whole debate is happening against a backdrop of a competition for power. You got US is the world's largest, most important economy, the world's largest military force. And China is rapidly catching up.
You can frame it as a US-China intellectual property or technology arms race, and that somehow Huawei has got caught up in the middle of that. But at its core, it comes down to whether or not there is a realistic risk or threat of the Chinese state having some sort of influence over that technology in the future. And that either is a risk or it isn't a risk. And other countries, America isn't alone in taking the view that it's not happy with that risk. Australia, for example, have taken the same stance, and they're not having Huawei involved in their 5G.
The UK has Huawei involved in its 5G. Ireland, through AIR, has Huawei involved in its 5G. Most of the world outside of Australia and the US, Huawei is actively, those countries that are busy building 5G have Huawei involved. There is a piece of Chinese legislation which was enacted in 2017 called the National Security Law. And that National Security Law says that Chinese citizens would be expected to cooperate with the government in terms of national security. And that is at its heart when this issue kicked off. Now, in truth, most countries in the world have an obligation on their citizens to act in the interest of their national security. And the Chinese government has said repeatedly that the national security law of China only applies in China. If you look at what the UK government have done, for example, they've also had concerns about Huawei and its security. So what did we do? We built a cybersecurity evaluation lab, which is governed by the British government and the security services, and they monitor every piece of technology that we make.
In light of these tensions that are there between East and West now, is there more of a Chinese nationalism emerging?
I think it's probably fair to say that there is something happening, and you know, it's a little bit, you know, any country that comes under attack from another country is by default going to defend itself. China has been occupied by Japan in the past, by Korea in the past, so they've got a history of occupation. They shook that off. They have a history of famine. Going back, you know, there are hundreds of millions of people still alive in China who lived through a famine. And now the attack is, they feel the attacks are unjustified. They feel the attacks are trying to hold China back, trying to stop China's rise, trying to stop China's innovation. And by the way, back to the nationalism point, if you go back 10 years ago, even I would admit that most of the technology in China was not well designed. It was probably, there was this copycat culture. But over the last 10 years, there's been a huge change.
When you take the Huawei complex, are there very large numbers of people working there at head office? What's it like? Because I know sometimes in China, we often can't get a handle on what their views are about the West and about Europe. They seem to maybe admire lots of things about European culture and history and so forth, but then also they do things their own way. How does that all reflect itself?
We have a new R&D centre in Songshang Lake that's just been completed. It's modelled on 12 European cities, including Oxford, Paris, and various other cities. And, you know, I'm very conscious that describing it on words on radio probably makes it sound like Disneyland. And many people who've come to see it have come with that trepidation. But when they get there and they see it, they go, you know what, this is pretty special. Where else in the world can you travel through 12 European cities? All pretty authentic designs, high-quality buildings, high-quality facilities, with a Swiss train that runs on a circle line that connects all 12 villages. So you can travel on a circle line train through 12 European cities in a matter of 15 minutes.
I presume Dublin or Letterkenny didn't make the cut, Joe, did they?
You know, I think maybe Letterkenny or maybe Greencastle might be in the next iteration, but it didn't make the first draft.
Any plans to get back closer to home or maybe go back to Donegal at some point when you retire?
I'm not quite retirement age yet. China keeps me young, the job keeps me busy. My kids live in London. They came to China for a while, but it didn't work out for them with school, so they're back in London. My home is still in London. At some point I'll retire. I have land in Donegal. I have plans with planning permission to build a house. I haven't got around to building it yet. You know, Donegal in Ireland generally, but Donegal specifically, and you might understand this, Richard, it's one of those places that you kind of have to leave to fully appreciate. You know, when you grow up there, you live there, you go, this is quiet and boring, and I want to go somewhere with brighter lights and more excitement. But once you leave the country, you start to understand its benefits more than you do when you live there. So it's certainly I'll retire there. I'm not quite ready to hang up the boots yet. When I finish with Huawei, I'm going to spend a year traveling in China taking photographs. I'm a photographer as well. I've got a few books to write. And whether I write those books in Ireland, in my new home in Donegal, or in the UK, or a mix of both, we'll have to wait and see.
Joe Kelly, Vice President of Corporate Communications at Huawei there.